Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, and we're talking native plants with two guests for you today. Molly Fifield-Murray, she's been with us, Molly, a long, many, many, many times.
Well, we won't say, will we?
We won't say how many or how long it's been, but it's been a while. It's great to have you back.
Since we were in school together.
Yeah. Back in the day.
Yes.
Oh, and today also Susan Carpenter's with us. Susan, with the UW-Madison Arboretum as well. You're the native plant gardener there. Oh, you know what? It always helps if I turn your microphone on. So you're the native plant gardener?
That's correct.
And you've been there for a while now?
13 years. Yep.
So a long time. So it's great to have you come be with us today.
Great to be here.
Yeah, as we talk about native plants. And, man, this is the time of the year. I'm enjoying going through the neighborhood, our own neighborhood, and my little three-mile jog in the morning. And I'm seeing a lot more native plants. It's, you know, over the last 5 years, more and more are showing up, Molly.
Oh, I think it's a tremendous change from when Daryl Morrison brought native landscaping back to the university and Lori Otto started the Wild Ones back in the 70s. You see them everywhere, and you're starting to see less and less pure lawn grass, mm-hmm. and it's much better for the environment.
Yeah.
And it's much more interesting to walk down the street.
Oh, it's a lot more interesting. And, you know, it's fun to be able to talk about native plants for people. You don't have to have a huge area necessarily to have an interesting native plant planting.
Right. You can do something on a very small city lot. My daughter on Milwaukee Street has a rain garden that's quite tiny and still does the job, so it doesn't take much space.
You know, I need to mention that President Barack Obama will be delivering a statement on the economy. I want to get that in right now. And talking about new steps to strengthen financial transparency and to combat money laundering and corruption and tax evasion. I should have mentioned that a minute ago, but you can listen to that right now. If you want to listen to the president's speech, you can go to WPR.org, and that's WPR.org, and we're carrying that speech. So if you are not interested right now, and if you're interested in talking or listening to Barack Obama, go to WPR.org right now. Well, native plants, obviously, the Arboretum. Talk about the Arboretum for a minute and give us a little background on it.
Well, the neat thing is that we were just recognized by the state of Wisconsin as a historic place, recognizing not just the structures there, in fact, not even the structures there, but the ideas that have developed there. It was the first place to restore a prairie and begin the process of trying to figure out how to put ecosystems together. And native landscaping developed out of that. There had been a few things done out in the East Coast with woodland wildflowers and having them in your garden in the early 1900s. But for the most part, what started at the Arboretum in the 30s, restoring prairies and the ecosystems of the Midwest, really started at the Arboretum.
And it's, how many acres do we have out there? It's a big
1,200
acres.
1,200 acres. And it's sort of, I don't want to say divided up, but within those 1,200 acres, there are many different gardens and different areas set aside.
About 70 acres worth of what you would call gardens with our horticultural collection and then the native plant garden. But the rest of the property is largely wetlands, woodlands, prairies, and savannas that are in various stages of restoration or succession.
Yeah, it's really a treat to be out there. Mm-hmm. I don't think you ever get jaded, but when I go out there, you know, especially if I'm out there late in the day and the sun's, you know, it's just the most peaceful and relaxing and beautiful area that you can imagine right inside the city of Madison.
Right. It was designed very carefully by William Longenecker and actually his mentor, Franz Oost, in the 30s to have design characteristics to provide those feelings, but also they didn't know what would work and what wouldn't work, so there are some places that haven't worked as well as they expected, and the scientists since then have modified those in a way, particularly the oak savannas more recently and the wetlands in the last decade, to make them more viable places to visit.
I want to let our listeners, give our listeners a chance to join in. You may have some questions about native plants, how you might incorporate them into your garden. Some, maybe you have some questions about specific types of plants that could work for your area. I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. And, you know, spring is really one of the best times to visit the garden, and lots of things in bloom right now.
Right. Things are a little fast. Susan can pick up on that a little bit. This Saturday is our native plant sale.
Yeah.
It's always the Saturday before Mother's Day. And so that's something to come out for between 9 and 1 o'clock. Otherwise, the woodland wildflowers seem to be a little ahead of themselves, but the native plant garden is a little slow, it seems like, and then the horticultural, well, the lilacs have started blooming, so they're just about right on time.
Yeah, it's typically, I always figured about the second week of May was when they were kind of at their peak, Susan.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're seeing kind of unusual patterns this year. We had a very early warm period, and then it was cool for a few weeks. So the emergence and the flowering does depend a lot on the details of the weather any given year. But it's really beautiful right now.
Oh,
really worth seeing.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and then the aromas. Oh my word! You just want to lay down on the grass, which a lot of people do.
Right.
Just lay back and take it all in.
Right. It is the time of year when, and people say to you, oh, you're really lucky to work at the Arboretum. And many of us are in the building most of the time, but just walking from your car is worth it.
And that building, by the way, that is a really nice, a nice building.
Yes, and it was built in the 70s, the oldest part of it, and added on to about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's a visitor center. It's not open in the evenings, but it's open 9:30 to 4 on the weekdays and 12:30 to 4 on the weekends. There's some nice things in there for people to just learn about what's in bloom, where they should walk, a few informational things about bees or birds or plants.
And we'll go into a little more detail on the native plant sale. I want to get to the phones here too, but in terms of the plant sale, from 9 to 3, was it?
It's scheduled from 9 to 2, but we do recommend people to come early.
Yeah.
It's very popular.
Yes, and things go, and all kinds of things for sale, all kinds of plants.
Yes, we have a full range of plants for sale, from woodland species, ferns, and deep woods plants, out to the prairie plants. We have trees and shrubs available as well, all natives.
Oh, wonderful. Well, we'll talk some more about it, but Paul in Madison is up with a question, so let's go there. Paul, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, welcome, neighbors. And our property backs up to the Arboretum. And I just want to make a comment. I'm finding it really easy to grow native plants. And not only I started with a native plant garden in the backyard, but I have spring beauty, Dutchman's riches, lots of bluebells, prairie trilliums, starting all the way to my front yard, which I just mow around or I can transplant. And had I known natives were so easy to put into the front yard, I wouldn't have put so much bushkinia in for the early spring pollinators, which seemed like a good idea at the time. So could you just comment on what I just said, please?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I'll comment first and then let Susan take over, but it probably means you have the right species of ant in your yard, because most of the spring ephemerals, the seeds are transported by ants, so they're carrying them around. they might get hungry on the way back to the nest and eat off the little food packet and drop the seed, so that's why it's showing up in various places. But Susan can speak a little bit more into how easy they are to grow.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. It is true that the woodland plants can be a little slower growing, but sounds like you have the perfect conditions for them. And over time, they really do, even just a few plants planted in the proper location, can, if you're just patient, they can spread themselves, as Molly described. Some of them can spread by underground stems and form large patches. And this, and then if you have good weather for the spring ephemerals, as we're having this year, it's just beautiful for several weeks at a time. And of course, it's important for people to remember that they won't have those flowers all year round, that after a time, these when the canopy closes, these plants will be dying back and ready for next year already. So it's great that you've got a good display now, Paul, and thanks for your comments.
Yeah. Appreciate it very much, Paul. Thank you. Colleen in Green Bay has something for us. Hi, Colleen.
Hi. I'm transitioning my flower beds to native plants, and I started planting native plants last summer. And I noticed that they grow a little bit slower than the rest of the plants in my garden. And so I'm just wondering if there's anything I can do to try to speed up or help them along in their process.
I guess, Colleen, my advice would be the most important thing would be to make sure that the plants that you're planting are well matched with the site. So, for example, if you have a shady site, it's excellent to have plants that can grow well in shade. And if you try to plant sun-loving plants in an area that's slightly too shady, they will not grow as fast and they won't spread as fast. They may not flower as much. So that match between the site and the plants is very important. Did you have a particular plant in mind?
I'm growing Canadian anemone, I believe is the name.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
So how does that require of? That does not require full sun, does it?
Canada anemone, in my experience, can do well in full sun at this time of year. It's a short plant, so it doesn't compete well with other plants that would be tall at this time. But it spreads by rhizome, so it really creates kind of a ground cover effect. And I would say partial shade is probably its perfect habitat, or soils that have a little bit more moisture, because it doesn't handle dry conditions very well. So with Canada anemone, I would go with a kind of a moister soil or a semi-shaded area, which is going to be moister for longer. And it's a spring plant, so it's getting its leaves now, will be blooming shortly, and then it will be past blooming during the summer, but it will still be green, leafy ground cover. So I've had really good luck with it, and I hope you will too, and watch the moisture for it. It doesn't like dry.
It doesn't like dry. So, and so how does it, you know, Colleen asked about growing faster. I think you meant spreading, right, Colleen?
Yeah. It's in a pretty shady area right now, but I think I might try to water it a little more. I was worried I was watering it too much last year, so maybe I'll just try a little bit more. So.
Yeah, I have a lot of it growing, and when I see your question about growing, about spreading more, I've kind of the opposite. I thought the question might be the opposite, because ours spreads just really, really prolifically. Although other plants can be growing with it, and they can come up through it, and you can also divide it very easily. If you get it growing really well in an area, you can always just take out divisions of it and move it to other areas to try it and see how it works as a ground cover in other areas of your yard.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling, Colleen. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You have a gardening question. What about incorporating native plants into your garden? What have been your experiences? What about pollinators and attracting pollinators to your yard? We can take that up as well with our guests today, Molly Fifield-Murray and Susan Carpenter. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at native plants today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest Molly Fifield Murray and Susan Carpenter from the University of Wisconsin Madison Arboretum. Always great to have the, Molly come by. Welcome for the first time to Susan. And welcome to you. If you're listening for the first time, join in at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Mary in DePere has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question about composting. I have a chicken coop that I spread cedar shavings in, and when I clean that out, I put it on a compost pile, and I'm wondering what that compost pile is going to do to the pH level in my garden because of the cedar shavings. Is it going to change it so that some things will not grow?
How much of it, how much are we talking about here? Are we talking about a bushel basket full or?
Well, the compost pile is now about 4 years old, and it's, it's about, I would say, a cubic yard.
Cubic yard. I was wondering, just in terms of the amount of cedar shavings, would that be a tenth, 10% of the?
No, it's all cedar shavings.
Oh, it's all cedar shavings and manure, right?
Right.
Nitrogen.
Right.
Okay, gotcha.
And cedar shavings, as opposed to cedar shavings instead of pine shavings, are because in horse stables, it's frequently not cedar but pine. So you're quite sure it's cedar?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I get the big bales from, like the wheat farm. And that's okay. What I spread in the chicken coop.
Okay, because cedar has some antibacterial, antifungal properties that might be negative, but the horse shavings are probably okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Mary, I think I would be curious. I don't know very much about the soils in your area, but what kind of pH are you starting with?
Well, the soil is very heavy. It's mostly clay.
Okay.
I've never tested the soil, so I don't know what the pH level is. I haven't had trouble growing things, but I'm just leery about putting that on there, and maybe I should just save it for my blueberries and the hydrangea if it's going to change the pH to, more acidic.
I would check to see if it actually is cedar because it's almost on you. I mean, you should almost be able to tell by the smell.
Okay.
But I'd look and determine that because otherwise if you run that through your compost pile and it composts before you put it down.
Mm-hmm. You have the manure from the chickens balancing things out a little bit there.
Yeah.
I wouldn't worry about it making it too overly acidic.
No.
It's most likely to make the soil, which you said was very heavy, to make it more friable, that is to say, easier to work and easier for the plant roots to penetrate.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. There we go. Thanks very much for calling. But I would check next time you go to buy a bale of it, check and find out what it is for sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't use cedar in something that I wanted the plants to grow in. You typically use cedar on the edges where you don't want the plants to grow as well. And that's why you use cedar in greenhouses and other places because it has some resistance to the growth of things.
Yeah. Thanks again, Mary. Here, let's go to Mary in Onalaska next. Hi, Mary.
Yes, I bought a property last year and I'm facing the lake Onalaska and it's got a slant to it. And we're surrounded by woods, and I have an area that the grass won't grow. Is it possible to put, like, red clover or anything like that to bring in the bees from my garden?
There are probably some pretty good ideas. I bet you our guests today, both of them would have some pretty good ideas about native plants that you could put in there that would do a great job. Susan, what about it?
Well, it would be important to know how much light is actually reaching the area, but for a slope like that, you would have as long as you match the plants to the site, as I've said before, mm-hmm. you want to get. It's really good for the bees to get a mix of plants so that you have blooming throughout the season. They do Bees will use red clover. Some bees will use red clover, but they will also use native plants preferentially if they're available. So I do like to recommend a sequence, so the mix of plants in the area would be a sequence of flowering throughout the season so that the bees always have a resource to use. There's never a time when they don't have food and nectar and pollen to work with.
Do you have a shady area there, Mary?
Yeah, it's like I'm surrounded by woods, so mm-hmm. it's shady most of the whole day.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's some natives that will do well in shade for sure.
Right. You'd probably want to go in that case with more woodland plants and maybe some shade-loving grasses to help you hold the slope there, depending on how steep it is. So a mixture of grasses and flowers would be, in this case, probably mostly woodland flowers. You could also use sedges. There's a couple of sedges that work well in some shade, if the shade isn't too deep, Pennsylvania sedge or Sprengel's sedge, which is another spring blooming sedge that's a little bit bigger and very lovely at this time of year.
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
All
thanks.
Right.
Yeah, thanks, Mary.
Thanks.
And for a listing, what would be a... Prairie Enthusiasts probably would have a good online list if you go to a place like Prairie Nursery. If you come to the plant sale, plant sale Saturday, you've got there's a whole list. The Friends of the Arboretum has a list, do they not, Susan?
Yes, they do. They have a wonderful sheet that shows the shrubs, vines, trees, ferns, entire page of the woodland plants and two entire pages of prairie plants. And it's a very handy resource because it shows you the light requirements and the soil moisture requirements of all the species, and then bloom time, the height of the plants, and so forth. So it's an excellent resource even if you're just planning for purchasing plants at another time.
Yeah, so Mary, where can Mary or anybody else get a copy of that?
Well, it's available through the Friends, and they can contact us at the Arboretum, and we can send those out to them.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I might just mention that we were talking earlier about woodland plants being ephemeral, so that they sort of disappear in the middle of the year, but the way you supplement them. So right now, the bumblebees really are liking Virginia bluebells, and they were on trout lily, some of the bees, not necessarily bumblebees, but trout lily, Dutchman's breeches, and things like that. But they disappear, so that's where the sedges and woodland grasses come in, and of course ferns. Now the ferns don't add to the bumblebees, but there are other wildflowers that stay more and bloom at different times. So wild geranium is starting to come on, and then in the summer you have... it has many names. Cimus suffuga is the Latin name. It bugbane or black cohosh or fairy candle blooms in the summer. And then there's one of my favorites is lion's foot. It's a wild lettuce of sorts, but it's quite lovely, and the bees are all over it in late summer. There's even in woodlands, there are fall asters. If it's an oak woodlands, there'd be Short's aster. There would be some goldenrods. People are worried about goldenrods, but they really are not an allergy-inducing plant. They just happen to bloom when ragweed does.
Yeah.
And bees are all over ragweed as well as the goldenrods. And that also brings, I know other people want to call in, but the other thing I wanted to mention today is that there's a big push to plant milkweeds for monarchs.
Yes.
And milkweed is an important plant because that's the only thing a larval form of the monarch will eat. But monarchs need plants that are in bloom for the nectars, for the adults, the rest of the year. So this time of year, the monarchs are just getting, they're not quite here yet, but they're getting close. So you need something in bloom. And then in the fall in particular, Susan's noticed monarchs preferentially using some of the goldenrods and asters. So
very cool. And You mentioned bees, and I was reminded. The Arboretum has, what, 10 species at least of bumblebees out
we
there?
We have at least 11 species of bumblebees.
11.
Mm-hmm. And really, in southern Wisconsin, we can only probably expect to see about 14 of them. So we have a tremendous diversity. But the bumblebees are only part of the story. We have, Wisconsin has over 400 species of wild bees.
Amazing.
So quite a variety of sizes, shapes, and using different resources. So we need, the native plants are a really good way to foster those populations. And it's really, as they say at the Xerces Society, which is an invertebrate conservation organization, if you build it, they'll come.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what I hope.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so Mary,
can
I hope that helps.
Can I ask you one other
sure.
question? I think I have, it's called vetch, V-E-T-C-H, mm-hmm. growing in one part of my yard. Mm-hmm. Is that something I should get rid of?
It depends on which kind of vetch it is. Is it crown vetch or one of the...
I don't know. See, I haven't watched the flowering yet, but I know the leaf.
Okay.
And I was just worrying about it because I was looking in my book, and I know there's a poison one, and then there's... The pink and the yellow, and I guess I have to wait and find out.
There are quite a few, there's quite a few different vetches, and so it would be important to know. So I think one thing you could do is you could send us when you get a photo of either the leaf or maybe the leaf and the flower, you could send that, email that to us at the Arboretum.
Okay.
At info at arboretum.
Okay.
At wisc.edu, and we'll be able to ID that, hopefully, for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be great, because I really didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, that's great, Mary. And so please follow up on that. We have the Arboretum up on our Facebook page, too, at the Larry Mueller Show. So you can, if you forget, you can always go there.
Okay, then. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Mary.
Thanks.
Thank you for calling. What about Dennis in Onalaska? Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I have a half acre, and in the back of my property, I have a very mature pine grove, and the understory has been trimmed, and, it's probably clear up to, 12 or 15 feet, and I'm wondering if I can plant anything in the pine straw underneath these big pine trees that would screen my neighbors.
So you're looking for taller plants that obviously...
Obviously will grow in acidic soil.
Acidic and shady.
Yep.
Tall-growing plants, shady and acidic. There you go. What about it, Molly?
Well, and I guess, are you looking for screening year-round or just when you're outside in the spring and summer? Or?
Yeah, just spring and summer.
Okay.
Like something like miscanthus, or I don't know if miscanthus will grow there, but...
Oh. Miscanthus,
I would go for native shrubs and some of them that grow tall enough to provide some screening would be some of the viburnums. So viburnum dentatum, viburnum... Nannyberry viburnum.
Lentigo.
If you want shorter ones, you could try some of the blueberries, particularly if it's quite acidic and sandy.
Yeah.
It's very acidic and very sandy.
Right. Black chokeberry, the aronias, black and red chokeberry grow on sandy acid soil.
And you'll get some birds in there then for
yeah,
as well.
And then you can always use the dogwoods. Gray dogwood in particular spreads quite a bit, is the perfect bird food for migrating birds, and will provide some screening. Even the elderberries provide some screening in those times of year. Anything else come to mind, Susan?
Well, I think if you can think about the shade issue as... if you can think about the edge of the area, I don't know what your layout is, but if you, the edge of a planting often, it definitely has more light than the interior. So if you can grow the shrubs, that maybe need a little bit more light than they would get in the middle of your pine stand, then you could probably get away with a few things that need a light shade or can survive well in a light shade rather than rather than a deep shade. So think about your edges and think about your borders, because if you have even a thin boundary of shrubs at the edge of your pines, that will still be a visual screening.
Yeah, for sure.
So something like hazelnut that can tolerate the same kind of soil conditions but would need a little bit more light than the viburnums and dogwoods.
Yeah, there we go.
It's quite thick.
Thanks very much. Good luck, Dennis. Sounds like you got lots of options there for things that are going to do well for you. And the berries, I definitely think about that, given your soil conditions. We have, we had a call from Sharon, who couldn't hang around, but she seemed to remember the Arboretum was trying to grow every tree native to Wisconsin within the Arboretum borders. Now, that may go back. You're dating yourself, Sharon. That goes back a few years,
yeah,
I think.
Well, the original goal was to reproduce the plant communities of Wisconsin, which would include most of the woody species.
Yeah.
They found that some of the things didn't work very well. Boreal forests, actually some of the trees grew, but the ground layer didn't do very well because Madison doesn't get the heavy snow that, say, the Upper Peninsula gets.
Mm-hmm.
And, the oaks and ashes and butternuts have all been hit by various diseases, but we probably are pretty close to just about everything.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I am actually jotting it down because I've never really heard us thinking about it in that quite that way as a recap of where are we now with that goal. I would say we do know that we have in our horticultural collection a native plant garden. If we count up just the native trees and shrubs, we're well over 120 species in that alone of native woody species. Now that's what I think, if we can include the shrubs, we're getting up there.
Yep.
So it's a great question, and it would be worth taking a different look at our data to see how close we are to that. We do take a more regional approach now, so we think about the southern part of the state, which is quite different from the northern, and we really focus our efforts and a lot of our our gardening advice for southern Wisconsin is just for southern Wisconsin plants.
Tom in Park Falls, you are next. Thanks for calling, Tom.
Morning, Larry.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
I would like to know if the berries on the staghorn sumacs are still viable, and how could I plant them?
I'll say that if a berry has stayed on a plant over a winter, the seed inside the berry probably needs more time to germinate because the drying of the berry around the seed will have induced some what's called dormancy in the seed. So the seed didn't get planted right away, didn't emerge or go through a crow or something right away, and so the dormancy created by that just means it would take more time. You could certainly plant them and just not expect them to spring forth within a week or something, mm-hmm. because there's a dormancy in there. I don't know off the top of my head the dormancy for sumacs. Sometimes when they've been in the berry, it's much more complex.
Yeah, I would say on that one, Tom, it might be a good experiment to try to plant some and keep track of that. You may need, as Molly said, there may be a delayed dormancy, and you may need to go through several seasons of cooling, warming, and check that out. I have not not familiar with their dormancy, the system of dormancy for staghorn sumac, but you could try it and see what you find. The seeds are actually rather large, and after that red fuzzy part comes off, and then the another little coating, that's the seed. So it's fairly large, and you might just try germinating some of them and see what happens.
Yeah, why not? Give it a shot, Tom. Thank you for calling. Alice in West Bend, your turn. Hi, Alice.
Hi. oh, this is such perfect timing. Our little neighborhood park in West Bend is the focus of a revitalization effort, partnering with the neighbors and the Parks Department. And at our first two meetings, one of the things that people really would like to see happen is that we incorporate a community gathering space, but that it attracts butterflies as well. So part of my assignment was to do research on it, and so here you are. Perfect. Thank you. I know that we need to have plants that are perennial, native, hardy, but this property is at the very top of one of the highest hills in the area, and there is virtually no protection. It's like the tundra in the winter. And the soil, my property is immediately adjacent to this small park, and I have rock when I dig, a rock and sand and gravel and heavy clay. So I don't know what the soil conditions are in the park. Our land, the subdivision land, was scraped almost clean of the black dirt. So we've had to bring stuff in order to grow in our yard. But I don't think the parkland has been disturbed, so there might be more topsoil. And we need recommendations for the best plants that are hardy but non-invasive. And although the pollinators include bees and they need sustenance, we're a little worried with all the kids in the park that we hope to attract that bees might be a problem. And so we're really focusing on attracting butterflies.
I'll let Susan speak to the bees, and it's an interesting question that people bring up about the bees, and I also let her speak a little bit more about specific plants, but the conditions you describe are actually perfect for a butterfly garden, and even if the topsoil had been removed, there probably wasn't ever very much on top of a situation like that. It's perfect for a sunny butterfly garden. It will ask the soil will require you to use a little bit more variety of prairie plants, probably, a mixed, it's not a sand prairie, it's not a lime prairie, it's a mixture, so you might get away with a wide variety of plants that will make it even more interesting. One thing that people sometimes forget for butterflies is that there are a few species that need grasses, so every butterfly garden should include some little blue stem or prairie drop seed or side oats grama, something like that, because the skippers in particular need the grasses. But then I'll let Susan speak about specifics.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think for attracting the butterflies, you want to think about, if specifically, you'd want to think about flowers that are where the flower is somewhat exposed. So you don't want flowers necessarily with long tubular structure. So some of the think of a flat open flowers, or flowers that are like rattlesnake master, which is like a ball shape, and that attracts a lot of the small the little eastern-tailed blue butterflies. We see that quite common. A lot of the asters, goldenrods, places where you have the flowers and the nectar exposed. You will also attract bees with all of those wonderful plants. So do go for a blooming sequence throughout the season. You want to have something for the early butterflies and then the mid-season and later. So you want to get that kind of seasonal variety. And you will have bees. One thing I'll point out, I mentioned the over 400 species of wild bees in Wisconsin, and about 85% of those bees are solitary bees. So they don't form colonies. They don't form any kind of social structure, really. And they're not defensive. So they don't sting, they don't chase people down, they don't come to your picnic or anything like that. And even bumblebees, I've worked with bumblebees for quite a few years now, and I've really never, ever been stung in all that time by a bumblebee, even working closely with them. So I know these are concerns about children, but I think you'll have a wonderful opportunity for the children at your park to not only study the plants and see the plants and enjoy them and enjoy the butterflies, but they will also be able to enjoy those bees as well. And it might be kind of neat to do an activity with them where they see how many kinds they can find on those plants once you have them installed.
I wonder if you might be able to elaborate the specific kinds of plants for early, mid, and late. I didn't know that, but I'm trying to find out, because we have two flower sales coming up here in West Bend. We have two different groups. One is a wildflower sale through a conservancy at Lac Lorraine, and another is the beautification, or Roots and Branches, the beautification committee that does more formal plantings throughout the city. But they do have their sales coming up, and I was going to try and grab as many of the right kind of plants.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't know. I know the ragweed, but I also understand goldenrod. But I understand there are different types of goldenrod, and
right.
So better. And we don't want anything that's invasive, because we have to contain these areas. They can't just be wild like a prairie.
Right. So you have planted beds, or?
Well, we don't have that done yet. It's been going into the overall plan, and so we're. Doing a large rectangle, and in that rectangle will be pairs of benches and game tables and chess and checker tables, and then the corners will be turned into garden areas.
Okay, so you'll want to get, I'll make some suggestions of specific plants that will cover some of the earlier season and then into the late season. So one of them that I'll suggest is Rattlesnake Master, as I mentioned before, and then the Blazing Stars or Gay Feathers. These are species of liatris, and for your situation I would go with the Rough Blazing Star.
Rough,
because that one does well under the soil conditions that you described. If you don't mind having a tall plant, mid to late summer, Joe Pieweed. That would be very tall, but it's a good, attractive plant for your butterflies. Pale purple coneflower. Culver's root.
Culver's root?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then some of the hyssops, the giant hyssops. So these are a lavender hyssop, a purple hyssop, and then asters, of course, for late in the season. And the pretty much... you know, a lot of the asters will be suitable for what you're hoping.
So good selection there, and thanks a lot for calling, Alice. Good luck with that. Let us know how that turns out. I'd love to see a photo down the road here once you've got it all up and running. Thank you so much. Talking today about native plantings, Molly Fifield Murray and Susan Carpenter from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. Our guests, Chris Molina, our on-air producer for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. We're visiting about native plants with Molly Fifield Murray and Susan Carpenter. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Net for this edition of Garden Talk. And, you know, there's an event coming up relating to not only the native plant sale, but also, there's been some research on bumblebee conservation, and there's a citizen science project I know you wanted to talk about a little bit, Susan.
Yeah, that's correct. When we have a native plant garden, we naturally draw in pollinators and insects and all manner of other wildlife. It's kind of the whole food web. But we focused in on bumblebees because we have a rare bumblebee at the Arboretum that was discovered there. And it's of particular interest. Kind of got us started on learning more about our bumblebees and how many bumblebees do we have, what resources are they using, which plants do they visit, how is their timing of their life cycle during the year. And with so many different species, we notice a lot of differences in a lot of those characteristics. So the way that we approach the citizen science project is to ask people to take photographs of bumblebees, because you can, if you've taken adequate photographs, you can identify bumblebees from pictures, which is different from a lot of the other tiny little bees that you might run across in the garden, where you'd need an actual sample of the bee. So we have a program where we collect photographs. People take photographs, they upload them, and we identify them. The volunteers can go to any area of the arboretum, any flowering area that they'd like to visit, and take their photographs. And then we also do on one afternoon per week, once the season gets a little further along, we will be going out with the volunteers if they like to, and doing this project together, so they can get a little more background about the bees. And then we come up with this is how we really find out what we know about. And people have taken this away from the arboretum to the point that they're photographing the bees downtown and photographing the bees at parks and other areas. And it's really exciting, because there is a national, or actually international, because Canada's included, program through the Xerces Society called Bumblebee Watch. So if you take a picture, Larry, at your garden, you can upload it to Bumblebee Watch. They will identify the bee for you, but you can learn a lot in that process. And then they have a map that shows the distribution of the bees. And the reason that's important is that for rare bees that are declining, and even for common bees, we can see a lot more about the distribution, because people everywhere are submitting their photos.
That's very, very cool. And so it's submitted on to, in the case of the Arboretum, you just go to the...
Well, the Arboretum Project, we actually have our own portal, because we started it years ago. Bumblebee Watch has been from the Xerces Society, which is accessible on bumblebeewatch.org. Anyone can put a photo from anywhere and map it and be part of that project as well.
That's very, very cool. Jean sent us a note on Facebook. She says, we're going to transplant about 30 big blue stem to a site that is full sun and has been amended with compost. Some of those grasses are 20 years old and are quite large. Can I split or quarter them? If so, what's the best way to transplant to make sure that they thrive?
It's interesting, because this is exactly how the Arboretum Prairies got started, by digging up very old plants and prairies. They had the Civilian Conservation Corps to help, so you might want to see who you can grab to dig the holes. As you've noticed, the root systems are quite large. The plants can be divided. The holes you dig should be fairly deep.
Yeah, we've moved different grasses and even fairly mature plants around. At this time of year, it's a particularly good time, because they're not actively sending up flowering stalks or anything. Big blue stem, I agree with Molly, you'll need a crew basically to do that, but you can divide those large clumps into quarters readily and then plant them into your new location. You'll want to keep the depth about the same, but dig out a substantial amount of material. You may lose a few in the process. They may dry out or not make it, but if you have that many that you're moving, I assure you the grasses will be, you'll have plenty in your new planting as well. And then another thing you can do, if you find that you want it even thicker in your new area, is just simply harvest some of the seed from this fall from those plants that you have, and just spread it in the area where your new planting is, and then the smaller plants will come in as well.
So how big are those balls on an old?
Well, big. It's an excavation project.
It really is. Oh, and deep.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't need, at this time of year, you'd basically be getting, you wouldn't be getting the whole root system by any means, but you'd be getting a substantial piece. And then as you divide it, just, you have to pretty much chop it with a shovel and then move them into the new location, water them in well your first day, and make sure that you're kind of monitoring how they're doing. Some Some may not make it, but
they're pretty hardy.
Yes, and this is a good time because right now they'll be starting their new growth. They'll be putting new roots out. You could do it. This, and they're also manageable. They're not 8 feet tall yet.
That's a very good point.
It is like transplanting a shrub.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not lawn grass. It has substantial. The roots go down 12 feet, but mm-hmm. you don't need to get all those.
You can go down 6 inches.
Well, I would go down a shovel's length, a couple feet,
maybe a foot. You'll have a hard. It's pretty sturdy going down, so you'll need to go down quite a ways to get it to get it popped out.
Steve wondered about honeyberry plants. He saw them for sale recently, wondering if that can be invasive like honeysuckle.
Well, I'm not too familiar with this is one of the pitfalls of common names. I'm not too familiar on exactly which plant honeyberry of the Lawniceras or the honeysuckle group that would refer to, so I'd need to research that a little bit. But there are native honeysuckles, which are vine form or sort of a shrub combination, shrub vine form, and those are not invasive. They're actually a good native plant. They're excellent in the proper site, and so we do need to keep in mind that there's the honeysuckle, the shrub honeysuckle that people are familiar with, that's the hybrid or the other forms that are not native. Those can become invasive. But the native forms, including our little dwarf bush honeysuckle, are really excellent plants to use in your native garden.
Very, very cool. Talking today with Molly Fifield Murray, who is the Outreach and Education Manager at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum, and Susan Carpenter joining us for the first time. She's a native plant gardener at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School Madison Arboretum. For Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. We're talking native plants and a whole lot more with our guests today, Molly Fifield Murray and Susan Carpenter of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. Hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe your own experiences to share with native plants. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, title, The Larry Mueller Show. And the native plant sale takes place tomorrow at the UW Arboretum. The Friends of the Arboretum put this on. And Susan, you want to tell us a little more about that native plant sale?
Well, it's really a tradition that's been going on for more than 25 years now, and it's a place where people just come together, a lot of enthusiasm over native plants now, as we've already mentioned. And this is the sale where you can really get the plant that's just right for, get the plant or plants that are just right for your yard or your garden. We have hundreds of plants set up in the big tent at the visitor center at the Arboretum. And we have a wonderful group of staff and volunteers who are putting this sale together behind the scenes. And then tomorrow the tent will open at 9 and people will start picking up plants to selecting plants and picking them up. We have information sheets that are available. So for each of the species that are selected, you can get a lot of details about it. And the plants will be arranged by shade-loving plants and sun-loving plants in the tent itself. So you can find what's best for you.
That's a great way to do it, actually. And mm-hmm. and also trees and shrubs.
Trees and shrubs as well, yes.
Are they bare? Is it bare root or is it?
No, they're in containers.
They're in containers,
yep.
Okay.
Yeah, we did have some bare root plants come in, some herbaceous plants come in, and we had some of our volunteers pot those up, mm-hmm. and they were beautiful. They're in beautiful shape. Some of them were even just coming up and coming into bloom, so you could really get a feel for what the plant looks like in your garden.
Oh, so that's tomorrow, and what are the times for?
Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, and it'll run until 2, unless everything's gone by by then. So it is very popular, and we do, you know, we have a great selection, and there's just a real great diversity of plants to choose from.
And what a great time to go out there because, you know, with all the blooming, mm-hmm. the lilacs, for example, which I love to go out there for the lilacs.
Well, and going on throughout the year, every Sunday at 1 o'clock, there's a walk at the Arboretum where people can see the native plants in place in the ecological community. So obviously this Sunday the walk will be in the woods because it's still woodland wildflower time. Wednesday evenings we have specific walks in the gardens, both the Long and Ecker Horticultural Gardens and the Native Plant Gardens, and that's something you can find at the Arboretum website, or if you stop in the Visitor Center, we have brochures. And at Trailheads, we have what we call the newsprint guide, which has a quarterly calendar. So every June will be a new one. There's been one out for the spring. So every Sunday, a walk of some kind. It's not always from the Visitor Center. Twice a month, we have things, especially for families, of either just a walk or a family program. And so this Sunday, the family walk is spring is here. It's mostly to, once again, take the kids out. But it's more oriented towards kids. Kids might not want to be on the longer walks that are 1 o'clock. I mean, older kids could be, but young kids, it's usually a longer walk. And some of the times you get to go to the parts of the Arboretum that you might not think of going to, particularly the Grady Tract, which is on the south side of the Beltline. When the Arboretum started, there was no Beltline, but they decided to put it right through the middle. And on the south side is a very different landscape, part of a moraine with a kettle hole and an outwash plain, so very different landscape, sandy soil, which you don't expect to see in Madison. So beautiful opportunities all throughout the year to see all these wildflowers in recreated ecosystems.
Very, very interesting. We have callers online. By the way, you can join in 800-642-1234. Summer in Eau Claire has a question. Hi, Summer.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have been thinking about experimenting growing ginseng in Wisconsin here because I heard it's good. And so my question is, where can I get some information on how to do it?
Wow,
That's a great question, Summer. Ginseng, I was able some years ago to study the wild Wisconsin ginseng and learned a little bit about it in cultivation or in some cases in woods cultivation. I'm not sure where you're planning to grow it, but I think your question about experimenting is a good It's a good approach because it can be a challenging plant to work with. It does have a good range of habitats that it can grow in, but it needs, you know, you need to be within that range for it. So semi-shade, medium shade, I would call it, I guess, and then you need pretty good soil moisture. So depending on what you're planning to do with that, you can order seed. I can't give you an exact name of someone, but I think if you look for a supplier, perhaps with the cultivated ginseng industry, you could get a hold of some seed, and then you could begin to experiment with propagating it. So it's a slow growing plant. If it's in the woods,
very slow
growing. Some of the plants that I studied were up to 30 years old. And so you need to have some patience with that. And it would be very interesting to know what you learn about it. It might turn out that you find out things that people aren't really familiar with in propagating that plant. And I'm sure would be excited to hear what you learn later.
Certainly. Yeah, I have properties in various type of soil and all of that, but all of that in western Wisconsin here. So I thought I'd try a few plants here and a few plants there and see which one.
I think studying, if you know of any locations where it is growing, studying that kind of location for the kinds of conditions that you'd want to try it in. But like I said, experimenting is going to be the way to go with that one.
and know that once you plant there, you can't replant in the same.
Yeah, I think in the woods, if it's more scattered, it's not as much of an issue. In cultivated fields, when it's grown really densely in cultivated fields, those fields are then rotated and not reused for ginseng. So,
in fact, never reused.
Mm-hmm, right. It's never reused. But if you're in woods cultivation and the plants aren't tightly spaced, you might be more mimicking the wild conditions. So
the ginseng growers I've talked with, you know, some of the guys that say, you know, occasionally they take very good, accurate maps and so forth, but occasionally they'll miss something and there'll be a square corner where the plants don't grow. And they'll go back and, 75 years ago, we had some ginseng in there. So it's an amazing plant, that's for sure, Summer. Good luck with that. The first time I've had a question about growing ginseng. So that's
interesting.
Great. Very good. Donna in Gladstone, Michigan, up next. Hi, Donna.
Hi. My daughter has a large lilac bush that she wants to move, but it's starting to bud out. Can we still move it this year, or will it kill the bush? Or
it's probably the worst time to move it. That,
okay.
That doesn't mean that you can't. It just depends on how much disturbance you want to do, how big of a root ball you want to plant, and how much you want to baby it along, and are you putting it into a hole that's the right size, the same size, and, you know, it can move out of that. Plants are putting a lot of energy into the flowers. That's why they exist, is to produce the flowers, and so it's a hard time to put extra stress on the plant. On the other hand, lilacs do reproduce somewhat by suckering, and so you can sometimes, if she's just not trying to move the plant out of the way and she's just trying to put it someplace else, you could take part of the plant and move it someplace else without damaging the whole thing.
Okay, so you could say, like, split it up.
Just take off a part of it, some of the smaller shoots and move them.
Okay.
They'll be tied together, you know, underground, and you'll want to cut them carefully.
Okay.
And when you put them in the new hole, you want to not curve the roots. You need to create a big enough hole to put it in there so that it has space to spread out.
Okay. And when is the best time to move it then?
Well, when it's gone dormant in the fall is usually a good time, and I believe lilacs can be moved then. Some things cannot because they would rot over the winter, but I believe lilacs can. Otherwise, you'd want to do it as early in the spring as you could get into the soil.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We got open lines to get you on pretty quickly. Anna on Facebook had a comment. She says, the city just planted a serviceberry tree in my curb strip. I'd like to transform the entire curb strip into garden. Which native plants would do well next to a serviceberry tree?
Well, aren't you lucky? Serviceberry is my favorite native tree, and it is very, very popular with both butterflies and bees, but birds. It is one of the first fruits available for birds, so every bird species that's nesting here in June is on that tree. Cedar waxwings will come to it before the berries are ripe. They must be able to eat green apples. So that's a lucky tree to be having in you. Yeah, I'm a little concerned at how it might do on a curb strip, so I'm glad that you're thinking of putting garden around it and mulching so that it's not a the soil doesn't get real compressed there. You know, if you're piling snow from a sidewalk or something, try not to pile it too heavily there. You know, spread the snow out on both sides of the sidewalk instead of dumping it right there. As far as the plants go, it depends on how much other shade there is. Service berries are not dense shade, and they like to sucker a little bit, but I have a wide variety of plants under service berries, anything from the spring ephemerals, Dutchman's breeches, and wild geranium and things like that, the sedge, Pennsylvania sedge that Susan mentioned, and there are probably some others, Susan?
Well, you want to probably keep, since it's on a curb strip, you probably want to keep everything pretty short. That can get to be, if you have tall plants there and they kind of flop into the street, into the sidewalk, and there's also visibility issues with, like, visibility for drivers and so forth. I don't know if there are any municipal regulations about that you might be wanting to be aware of. But if you stick with very short plants, kind of more of a ground cover type of height, then I think you'll be in good shape. So if the entire area is shady, you might want to go with more of a shady ground cover, maybe this Canada anemone that we've been talking about today, or a wild ginger if it's really shady. Otherwise, the sedge is a nice choice, or some of your maybe shorter grasses if it has a little bit more light availability.
There we go. Thanks for that question. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions. And callers online as well. And I want to go to Pat in Duluth, Minnesota. Let's go to Pat. Pat, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I've heard you mention the Xerces Society a few times, and I just wanted to put a real big garden plug in for that group because it's a small group of staff. I think they're under 30 people, and they are now doing work throughout the world, not just in our continent. But I can't praise them enough, and if people could get to know them and become members, they are truly amazing. So I'm looking at our bees outside now, and I just give them thanks every day. And I thank all of you on this program, too. So I just wanted to put a plug in for them, a huge plug.
Oh, thanks, Pat. And Susan, I know, wants to, and probably Molly as well. But Susan?
Yeah, I wanted to add, thanks, Pat, for that work. They have been they've been a great support to us, too, in the Madison area, and very supportive of the work that we're doing with the bumblebees and the rusty patch bumblebee in particular. They also have excellent, for the getting to the plant side, they also have some excellent resources, regional plant lists and so forth, right on their website. And excellent, so you look up your own area and the plant lists and all of the how-to for creating gardens that will support invertebrates and support pollinators is all right there. So it's a great, great resource.
And Xerces is spelled X-E-R-X-E-S, isn't it? Or Z-E-S?
No, X-E-R-C-E-S.
C-E-S. Uh-huh. All right. See, that's good thing I tried to spell. Now, hopefully I'll remember that. X-E-R-C-E-S.
That's right. It's named after a small butterfly that the Xerces butterfly.
Okay, that's where I was going to ask you that. Where did it come from? Because I didn't know.
And it's nice to remember that lots of people are working on pollinators. And in fact, our Native Gardening Conference in September is featuring one of the experts, Heather Holm, who's written a very nice book about attracting pollinators with native gardens. And that's September
18th.
18th. So coming up, plan for it now. I'm not sure. You might even be able to sign up already on our website.
Our website, it's registration's open online.
Oh, my goodness,
and
already.
We're in the early bird registration period. So anyone
who's interested. It's a good time to do it then, actually.
It's going to be a great conference.
And I would just mention one other thing that people should think about with bees is to be very, very careful what chemicals they buy when they go to a garden store, because there are a variety of chemicals that are allowed in the United States that aren't allowed very many other places in the world that are quite dangerous to bees. And some of them, the neonicotinoids in particular, are very, very dangerous to bees and are in a lot of the new chemicals. And they're sort of, well, if you don't look for them, you aren't necessarily going to know that they're there. And you really do not want to use those on your gardens. And be very, very careful about using any chemicals at all. But, you know, if you go to a garden store and something's on the shelf, you don't worry about it too much. But there are very dangerous chemicals there.
Yeah, they'll just decimate bees.
Yes.
So something to think about. We have Louise in Sturgeon Bay. I don't know if we have a chance. Thanks.
Hello.
Yes, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah, hi.
And you live along Lake Michigan?
Correct.
Well, you're not trying to screen from the lake, right? You're trying to screen from the road?
Right. No, I'm trying to screen from the property to the north.
To the north.
So I want to have some kind of a hedge that actually starts right at the high water mark and goes inland, I don't know, maybe 20 feet. And it's a partly sunny area, good soil, but it has to be very hardy because of the cold winds and just the freezing sub-zero temperatures you could get in the winter.
Yeah.
If you look around the landscape and look at what's growing near you in sort of the wilder areas, you will see a variety of things. What comes to mind is white cedar or arborvitae is a possibility for a pretty dense screen that might tolerate the conditions you're describing.
Oh.
Something that twigs out in winter doesn't have, you know, any kind of leaf.
Yeah.
Oh, you want it bare in the winter?
Yeah, I'd rather have it bare in the winter. It's a rental property that next to the north that's not occupied in the winter.
All right. Well, arborvitae.
I think that Molly's suggestion of checking some other areas, because you are talking about kind of a specific kind of microclimate in a way there right along the shore of the lake. So it would be interesting for you to look along the shore and, you know, visiting other folks or maybe at the ridges or something like that, and look at what kinds of things appeal to you that are growing in those kinds of conditions, and then see if those are available to use for your planting.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And boy, here we are. We're getting close to out of time. I wanted to remind everybody about the Friends of the Arboretum annual native plant sale. We've been talking about it a bit here, but it's tomorrow, so that's why we need to talk about it. I have hundreds of plants and trees and shrubs as well. If I were in your shoes, I'd show up at around 9 o'clock or
8:45,
yeah, or maybe even 8:45.
Pick up a number.
you can purchase your plants and then spend a little time around the arboretum. That's the way to do it.
Right. It's so beautiful there right now. And the interesting thing about the plant sales, you can learn so much, even if you're not buying very much this year. Buy a few things, but you can see the other plants associated with the ones you're picking up. You get information sheets about the plants that are very full of details, both about the flowers, but on the horticultural needs, the cultural needs of the plants. So very informative.
And lots to see. And thank you so much. Molly is retiring end of June.
That's right.
Well, hopefully we'll get you back here before the end of but if not, you've been wonderful on this show. Thank you so much for all you've done for us.
Well, it's been a big pleasure, and I have to say, we learn something every time. We've learned stuff today, and I'll still be around, probably be bothering people at the Arboretum volunteering and talking at various conferences and things. So
she'll be here.
It's been so different over the years, Larry, to just battling for native plants to it being a real movement.
Molly Fifield Murray. Susan Carpenter joined her today. Thank you so much for listening.